Well, it's very good to be here, to be asked by Ian to talk about something that I find fascinating in church history. You may wonder why we are here on a Thursday night in an evangelical chapel in rural England looking at the Oxford movement. Last month it was leaving Rome with Martin Luther. This month it's going back to Rome with John Henry Newman. Why is this in any way relevant to us? Well, the reality is that you cannot understand the Church of England today in particular without having some knowledge of this movement. And you also can't understand, I would suggest, the modern Roman Catholic Church without understanding the Oxford movement and John Henry Newman. Now, how did the Oxford movement affect the Church of England? Well, first illustration would be the buildings, the thing that we notice immediately. Now, this is Robin Hood's Bay in North Yorkshire, and in 1821, after their old church had been wrecked in a storm, they rebuilt, and this is what they built. You can see it's a fairly standard box dominated by a high pulpit and a gallery. If it wasn't for that little chancel off the end there, and you can see everything's pointed to the pulpit, you'd think that this was a nonconformist chapel, a free church. It's a Protestant building reflecting a Protestant understanding of the Church of England. Now, some 50 years later, a new vicar came and he built, near the village, a brand new church. And you can see how totally different it is. It's, as they would say, a Catholic church. It's medieval in style with that towering spire. The interior, you've got this rather dark nave, and everything is pointing to this apse with the focal point, not a pulpit, but an altar. What happened? Well, the Oxford movement is what happened. Now, Oxford is something of a world apart. Even today, you go to Oxford today and you see the colleges, you see in the buildings, even in the things that people wear sometimes. It's a world apart. But in 1833, which is when our story begins, it was even more so. There was no railway. The only way to get to Oxford from all over the country, and students did, was to come by stagecoach. The story is told that the last survivor of that regime, who was the master, the fellow in charge of Magdalen College, when the railway did come, he refused to admit that the railway even existed. And so students could arrive late for term, and he'd say, oh, he's coming such a long way, you know, the roads are so bad. Even though there was a railway that would get you there quickly, because he just refused to admit the railway existed. And in 1833, Oxford was like an Italian city-state. It had its own rules, its own regulations, its own laws, its own government, its own way of doing things. It was a world apart. Yes, there were nonconformists in the city, but not in the university. To be a student at Oxford in 1833, you had to be able to subscribe to the 39 Articles of the Church of England, and that will become important later on in our story. It was an Anglican world. At that point, about half, just under half, of all the ministers in the Church of England had been educated at Oxford. There was no theological education in the sense of seminaries or theological colleges, but you learned, these young men learned theology from the professors, all of whom, of course, were also Anglicans, at Oxford. The colleges dated back to the Middle Ages. Many of the regulations in the colleges dated back to the Middle Ages. Some of the students felt that some of the teachers in the colleges dated back to the Middle Ages. And most college fellowships could only be held by unmarried men, and to marry was to forfeit the fellowship and therefore the income. and reputations could be made and lost in the debating chamber of the Oxford Union. And here, in 1833, the Oxford movement began. It began in 1833. The Oxford movement proper ended it 12 years later, with the acknowledged leader, John Henry Newman, becoming a Roman Catholic. It's generally agreed that the Oxford movement itself began on the 14th of April, 1833, when a thin, somewhat ethereal-looking Anglican clergyman ascended the pulpit of St. Mary's, the university church, that's the pulpit in our picture, and delivered a sermon entitled National Apostasy. His name was John Keble, and he wasn't a revolutionary, quite the opposite. He was accounted by many to be something of a saint, and he was certainly a poet. He was 41, and he wasn't given to wild pronouncements, but he felt that these were wild times. Now, in 1833, England was in the middle of a great reform. They were talking on the news tonight about this so-called Great Repeal Bill. That's not its official name. But 1832, the Great Reform Bill had been passed. The Great Reform Act had just redrawn the electoral map. It had abolished the old rotten boroughs. These were seats where you could get two members of Parliament elected by seven people. You could imagine how you could buy the vote there, just take them all out to a nice dinner, and that's what happened. But these things have been abolished, and instead the new industrial towns like Manchester and Birmingham and Leeds had been granted MPs for the first time. No longer were most electors rural Anglicans. Many were now urban nonconformists. And Ireland, the Roman Catholics had a vote. Well, after parliamentary reform, the next thing the government looked at was church reform. Not in England, but in Ireland, where the established Church of Ireland represented less than 7% of the population, but was supported by taxes paid by everybody. What was more, this unrepresentative church had 22 bishops, including four archbishops. That's almost as many bishops as the Church of England, and twice as many archbishops. Many of these men were, as Owen Chadwick, the historian, puts it, spectacularly non-resident. And some parishes had no Anglican inhabitants at all, but a clergyman being paid to be the pastor of people he never visited, he never preached to, people who belonged to a totally different form of Christianity. The government thought that this needed to be dealt with. The government also relied to some extent on Irish Catholic votes. But to Keble, to those he represented, the Anglican establishment, it was national apostasy, the laying of unhallowed hands on holy things, the government robbing the churches. And so Keble ascended that pulpit and called this national apostasy. And it would be a mistake to think, however, the Oxford movement was political. It was primarily theological. Keble was one of a number of men concerned about a rising tide of what they saw as liberal theology in the Church of England, and moving away from definite doctrinal, dogmatic teaching and towards the idea that human reason was a final arbiter in things of religion. And so men were looking for a theological authority. And while there were some who went and saw that in the Bible and evangelicalism, the Oxford movement saw that authority as being in the church, which caused all kinds of problems, as we shall see. Now, who was John Keble? Well, basic facts, he was born on the 27th of April 1792 in Fairford, Gloucestershire, where his father was the vicar. And it was almost a matter of course that he followed his father to Oxford University. He was, and some of you here will applaud this, he's homeschooled. And he did very, very well at home. We have one little picture of his childhood, and it's a little boy with a Latin grammar in one hand while he uses the other to bounce a ball against the garden wall. And it was from this small country parsonage that in 1807 he entered Corpus Christi College, Oxford. He did very, very well, soon winning a double first in his bachelor's degree. Now, the most prominent college at the time was Oriel, where the provost, the head of the college, had gathered a great array of talent, and so, of course, he went off this young man with a double first. But Keble wanted to be a pastor like his father, and so he was ordained in 1815, served as a curate in a university parish, published in 1827 a volume of poetry called The Christian Year, but he was called back to Oxford in 1831, elected as Professor of Poetry, which was a 10-year post. He was regarded as a saint. He was a very serious man. To his mind, the Christian life was first of all a striving after holiness. Many clergy in his day were happy to receive the tithes, to draw their income, and to live the life of a leisured country gentleman. Not so Keble. He would be visiting the cottages in his parish, meeting with the people. And yet he was not an evangelical, but regarded the church as a society based on an unbroken succession of bishops going all the way back to the apostles. Society that you entered by baptism. Now, it's probably now is the right time to think about Romanticism. The Romantic movement influenced Keble profoundly. He's regarded as a Romantic poet. And Romanticism was something of a reaction to the Age of Reason. In the 18th century, reason was everything. Classical civilization was the model, and the Middle Ages was just the Dark Ages, when all these wonders of classical civilization had been lost and people went back to living in mud huts. Well, that's not strictly true. And in the early 19th century, people began to rediscover the Middle Ages. They began to look at the ruined monasteries and say, these were works of art. They began to look at the writings of the Middle Ages. There were men like Sir Walter Scott, who wrote novels of romance and derring do in the Middle Ages, set in the Middle Ages. They looked back on it as a time of chivalry and knights who were bold and brave. And then, of course, there was Wordsworth, a poet, who looked on nature as beautiful. In the 18th century, the idea was we tame nature. The Romantics said, no, we look at nature, we love nature, we admire nature. We look upon the golden daffodils, I wandered lonely as a cloud, as Wordsworth. We look on the daffodils and how beautiful they are, without man doing anything. And then we have Turner, the painter, who would paint these beautiful romantic pictures, often landscapes showing places like Tintern Abbey. Our background comes from another romantic painter. And again, these Gothic churches were appreciated once more. People began to seek to restore them. And Keble looked back on the Middle Ages with a certain love and appreciation and felt, even as he'd been taught, that the continental reformers like Luther had gone too far, and the English reformers called them to come back to a true Catholic appreciation of the church. Rome also had gone too far. The Roman Catholic Church had really ceased to be Catholic. So Keble and those like him felt. that they must go back instead to a true Catholic understanding of the Church. Well, Keble had, as a college tutor, many pupils. Among them was a man called Richard Hurrell Froude. Froude was a young man in a hurry. Now, one reason in a hurry was that he died of TB when still in his 30s. And for much of his college career, he was suffering from this illness that would kill him. So he's in a hurry to accomplish something before he died. He had been taught by Keble. He was born on the 25th of March, 1803, and like Keble, his father was a clergyman. His father, the Reverend Robert Hurrell Froude, was the rector of Dartington in Devon and the Archdeacon of Totnes. He was educated at Eton and went up to Oxford in 1821 to Oriel College. He too became a Fellow of Oriel, but by 1830 he had begun to show signs of tuberculosis, the illness that would kill him. And he was very attracted, like Keble, to the Middle Ages. Oxford was, perhaps still is, one of the great places in England to appreciate the art and architecture of the Middle Ages, in the colleges, in the churches. He also came to look at the old monasteries as romantic and wonderful. He became a great believer in clerical celibacy, the idea that clergymen should never marry. And he began to regard friends who did get married as having somehow failed in their vocation. Perhaps it was his illness that coloured this. But the monasteries, of course, were places where unmarried men lived together, were very much like Oxford colleges, only more so. And if he was attracted to the romantic ideal of the monastery, Froude wasn't a hermit. He was an outgoing sort of man, a man who could be and often was very, very much an agitator, a man who would go into a room and throw out some outrageous comment just to provoke a reaction. In fact, they coined a word for it in Oxford, fraudacity. Looking back on his life towards the end, he would say that the one great deed that he had done was to introduce Keble to John Henry Newman. Now, if you've heard anything about the Oxford movement, you'd have heard of John Henry Newman. Newman was born on the 21st of February, 1801. He was the son of a banker. And he was born in central London, where his father's bank was based in Lombard Street. He attended Great Ealing School, which was at the time regarded as the finest private school in England, and had a marvellous educational record. And it was there that he met a man called Walter Myers. Walter Myers was an evangelical, and he taught classics at the school. Now, it's sometimes stated that Newman came from an evangelical family. This is not true. This comes from people misunderstanding what Newman said about himself. His parents were middle-of-the-road Anglicans. It is true that both he and his younger brother Francis embraced evangelical opinions at one point in their lives. And it was because of Myers that Newman, at the age of 15, experienced some sort of evangelical conversion as he understood it. Myers was associated with the Clapham sect and introduced Newman to such men as Thomas Scott, the commentator, successor of Newton. And it was there at that school where Newman read Scott's The Force of Truth, the autobiography in which Scott recalls how he went from a man who was almost a Unitarian to being an evangelical. And also there he read Scott's commentary on the Bible. Newman says, in fact, that in one sense, humanly speaking, he felt he owed his very soul to Thomas Scott, the evangelical commentator. Now, Newman's father's bank, about that same time, collapsed. The bank failed. His father had to go off into the country and became a brewer for a time. Newman therefore couldn't become a banker, and so he was able, using what funds his father could get together, to go up to Oxford. And there his evangelicalism was eroded by the people he met at the colleges, people who managed to convince him that the Bible wasn't enough, the Bible wasn't sufficient, who undermined the Bible. And so he struggled. He heard about apostolic succession and came to regard every bishop as a little pope in his own diocese. He turned, in fact, on his youthful evangelicalism and began to hate it. Keble at first was wary of him. He felt that Newman was becoming a liberal. But Froude managed to bring the two together, and Newman became a follower of Keble, being impressed by his great holiness. Now, at this time, he began to move towards ordination. And in 1826, Newman was ordained. In 1828, he became vicar of St. Mary's, the University Church, that great pulpit in the centre of Oxford. And he began to preach sermons that soon became famous. That set of books there is Newman's Anglican Sermons. That's a photograph of the ones, well, the complete set in my library. And these sermons became famous. They were full of the same ideas as Keble, especially the emphasis on personal holiness. The first is on Hebrews 12:14, and the title is Holiness Indispensable to Future Blessedness. It's that phrase he picks up, follow after holiness, without which no one shall see the Lord. The truth itself, he said, is declared to us in one form or another in every part of Scripture. It is told again and again that to make sinful creatures holy was the great end which our Lord had in view in taking upon himself our nature. And taken together, his sermons, they're primarily moral, and it's an impressive call to holiness. He also was a great believer in clerical celibacy. He felt, in fact, at the age of 15 that the Lord was calling him to a celibate life. Well, I suspect a fair number of evangelical young people have felt that, but Newman clung to it throughout his life, and his study of the church fathers of the medieval church only served to confirm that and gave him a theological basis for it. At the same time, he was confronted by the dangers of unsettled notions in religion, first of all by his two brothers, Charles and Francis. Charles became a radical socialist and actually gave up all religion, while Francis passed through Anglican evangelicalism to Plymouth Brethrenism. In fact, he went to the Middle East as a missionary, and eventually into Unitarianism, the denial of the deity of Christ. Both of them, Newman felt, were affected by rationalism, which he came to see as, therefore, a great enemy. It also meant, however, since his brother Francis had gone through radical Protestantism to Unitarianism, that he came to see evangelicalism as a danger, since it had apparently led his brother Francis into full-blown apostasy. Another man who came to influence him towards this view by his actions was Joseph Blanco White. Now, his real name wasn't Joseph Blanco White. He was Spanish, but the English couldn't pronounce his Spanish name, and so he got renamed Blanco White. Blanco White had been a Roman Catholic priest. He converted to Anglicanism, and he spent some time in Oxford before he too became a Unitarian. While he was there in Oxford, and he was an honorary member of the Oriel Common Room, he had taught Froude and Newman about the Roman Catholic breviary, something that he later regretted when he saw that they were moving back in the direction from which he had come. Well, in the winter of 1832, Harold Froude's health was dreadful. His father took him for a Mediterranean cruise away from all the cold and snow of England, And frowned ever the man who wanted company asked Newman to come with him. And so the young vicar agreed, had a holiday together. Together they explored Malta and Rome and Naples and these ancient cities in Italy. Newman was impressed by the greatness of the Roman Catholic system, but at the time he regarded the Pope as Antichrist, and so he saw it as a malign, a wicked greatness. Proud, on the other hand, was not so sure. In Italy, Newman became very, very ill and languished between life and death for many days. At last he recovered, and as he rose in his bed, he wrote a poem that is still very famous today. If you go through many of the old cemeteries and graveyards, you'll see some verses from it penned on written on gravestones. Lead kindly light amid the encircling gloom, leave thou me on. The night is dark and I am far from home, leave thou me on. Keep thou my feet, I do not ask to see the distant scene, one step enough for me. I was not ever thus, nor prayed that thou shouldst lead me on. I love to choose and see my path, but now lead thou me on. I love the garish day in spite of fears, pride ruled my will, remember not past years. So long thy power hath blessed me, sure it still will lead me on. O'er moor and fen, o'er crag and torrent, till the night is gone, and with the morn those angel faces smile, which I have loved long since and lost a while. Newman himself struggled, as the poem illustrates, with unbelief. He had been convinced by certain persons, that he'd heard some of the things we heard last night. He had been convinced that the Bible was not enough, and that left him seeking authority, infallible authority, certainty, somewhere else. And that eventually was the story of his pilgrimage. Well, returning to England after this holiday, which had been so important in Newman's life, Newman and Froude found Keble agitated because of the turmoil in church and state. If the Irish bishoprics could be suppressed, what next? The disestablishment of the Church of England? What then? It was this sermon on national apostasy, a call to arms, a call to action. But what action? Well, Newman and Froude, of course, were far from the only ones who listened to Keble and responded. In fact, one of the most prominent men was a man called Hugh James Rose, who was rector of Hadley in Suffolk. That's his church there. And in the background, you can see his rectory. Now, that's quite a parsonage, a bit more impressive than our Bethel Mounts. It's now called Hadley Deanery, and of course is now in private hands. Rose called a conference there of a few picked men from the 25th to 29th of July 1833, but only Froude of the Oxford men was there. At the conference they talked about associations, addresses to Parliament. What shall we do? Well, Froude, being the man he was, the agitator, was thoroughly bored by the whole thing. Associations, addresses to Parliament. What will they achieve? He said, we need to give the Church of England a kick in the seat of its collective breeches. What will we do? Well, he went back, met with Newman, Keble and some other friends, and they decided on tracts. They would write tracts. Tracts, of course, were well known. They were used by the evangelicals, largely evangelistically, the way we use tracts today. But these tracts would be not for the unbelievers, but for the clergy, to get the clergy to wake up and see what was going on, to prepare for the possibility of disestablishment while doing everything in their power to prevent it. And so in late August, the first of the Tracts for the Times by members of the University of Oxford appeared. It was very short, just a couple of pages. I have here a modern reprint of pretty much a third of the Tracts. There's effectively two other volumes this size. These are all ones by Newman. And they were relatively short, and the first tract was called Thoughts on the Ministerial Office. It had a very simple idea behind it, apostolic succession. Newman began the tract this way. He said, "I am but one of yourselves, a presbyter. Therefore I conceal my name, lest I should take too much upon myself by speaking in my own person. Yet speak I must, for the times are very evil, and yet no one speaks against them." And so the tract began. It wasn't long before he reached his main argument. "I fear we have neglected the real ground on which our authority is built, our apostolical descent." Here was this whole authority issue that so troubled Newman. If not in an infallible Bible, where did authority lie? In the church. But where is the church? He identified the church with this idea, apostolic succession, that there is between the apostles and the present day an unbroken line of descent. And in his case, in the High Anglican case, as a Roman Catholic case, where they found that was in ordination of bishops, the line of bishops. And so Newman was saying to his Anglican fellow clergyman, "Your authority rests in the fact that you were ordained by one of the descendants of the apostles." The appearance of this tract caused a sensation, and more tracts follow. First three by Newman. The fourth, on adherence to the apostolic succession, was by Keble. There is in these tracts a real sense of crisis. The church is in danger. The Church of England is to be disestablished, and the result will be that she will be but one sect among many. What makes us different from all the sects, they asked. The apostolic succession, they replied. Eventually there would be 90 of these tracts, of which one third, 30, were by Newman. Keble, the next most productive, produced 8. And Froude wrote only 3, maybe 3.5. The tracts also gave a name to the movement, Tractarianism, and the members were called Tractarians. The opinions were very decided. In Tract 10, Newman wrote, "The bishops stand in the place of the apostles. And whatever we ought to do, had we lived when the apostles were alive, the same ought we to do for the bishops." And he called on people to honour the Anglican clergy as entrusted with the awful and mysterious gift of making the bread and wine Christ's body and blood. Well, that last was so inflammatory, so outrageous, that in the second edition, which is what's republished in here, it says dispensing the body and blood of Christ, not making the body and blood of Christ. By December, a dozen tracts had been issued, most of them by Newman. And copies were circulated throughout the university and came into the hands of many people, among whom was the Regius Professor of Hebrew, Edmund Bouverie Pusey. He'd eventually contribute 7 tracts, and his accession to the movement would prove an epoch in its history. Newman said, "With Pusey, we gained a name." Edmund Bouverie Pusey was an aristocrat, proper blue blood. He was born on the 22nd of August 1800, as befits an aristocrat named Pusey, at Pusey House in the village of Pusey, where his father was the lord of the manor of Pusey. He had a first-class education, first attending a private prep school and then going on, of course, to Eton. He went up to Oxford in 1819, where he was undergraduate at Christ Church College. In 1823, he'd been elected a Fellow of Oriel, but had never been all that close with Keble, Newman and Froude. Pusey was a scholar of Oriental languages, which in those days meant Hebrew, Aramaic and Arabic. In 1824, he had married, something which of course shocked the advocates of celibacy in the movement, but really Pusey wasn't all that bothered, being at this point much more sensible. The following year he had been appointed the Regius Professor of Hebrew and had moved to a fairly palatial set of rooms within Christ Church College, which he would occupy for the rest of his long life. He had taken little notice of the opening of the movement, but as the tracts poured out, he began not only to read them, but to sympathise with these men who were determined to wake up the slumbering Church of England. He was the scholar of the movement. Not that the other men were not scholars, but that their scholarship was less than his. There was a massiveness about Pusey's scholarship. Maybe you've come across his commentaries on the Minor Prophets or on the Book of Daniel. Spurgeon spoke very highly of both of them. He recommended them in his commenting and commentators. In spite of some of the extravagancies of medieval ideas in them, they are excellent. And Pusey's insistence on the absolute historicity of the Book of Daniel was most unusual for one in a university setting in his day and age. He was very familiar with the learning of Germany. He read German theology, and yet he was resolutely conservative in his view of the Bible. He was, of course, not an evangelical, but a high church Anglo-Catholic. But much of what he wrote on the Bible is still very useful and readable today. Pusey, at the end of 1833, wrote his first tract, Tract 18. The subject was fasting, that of self-control, self-discipline through fasting. And he was the first of the tract writers to put his initials on the tract. And everybody knew who he was. Therefore, he gave them a name, for soon the Tractarians were known as Puseyites. In August 1835, his second tract, number 66, was published, advertised as a supplement to Tract 18. It was even longer than the original, and certainly not the sort of short, sharp shock that Froude had envisaged. His next contribution was even further from the original brief pamphlets, a weighty treatise on the doctrine of baptism that was issued as three tracts, numbers 67 to 69, and was well over 300 pages long, all put together. He changed the character of the tracts. The Tractarians, as this party were known, believed that the Church of England was Catholic in its character. By this they meant it was neither Protestant nor Romanist, but reflected the Church of Antiquity. And they particularly looked back to the 4th and 5th centuries, men like Athanasius, Augustine, Chrysostom, the Cappadocian Fathers. Newman looked to Athanasius above all others as his father. Pusey loved Augustine and Keble the poet, loved the silver-tongued, the golden-tongued Chrysostom, the great preacher. The great exception among these was Froude, who preferred the Middle Ages and had little time for the Fathers. Now, this love of the fathers was shown practically when, in 1836, a series entitled The Library of the Fathers was begun. This was a series of English translations of the major writings of the Church Fathers, and was intended as a sort of follow-up to the tracts, giving English readers access, in some cases the first time, to the writings of Christian antiquity. The first volume, which was a translation of Augustine's Confessions by Pusey, was published in 1838, and these are some of the volumes. Keble really receives from the movement after 1835. He married in the October of that year and accepted a parish living at Hursley in Hampshire, which left Newman and Pusey the chief leaders, since Froude, in November 1833, had been forced to go to Barbados for reasons of his health. 1836 was in many ways the high watermark of the movement. Not only was the Library of the Fathers begun, but in that year they gained their own journal, the British Critic, a theological magazine with a long history, which had come up for sale. Newman was appointed editor, and this gave them an outlet for a varied repertoire of articles dealing with both history, theology, and, of course, the affairs of the day. It was also the year of the first great controversy. In that year, Wren Hampton was appointed Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford. That's effectively the top theology professor. Now, Hampton's personal beliefs were actually quite orthodox, to the extent, in fact, that he was quite happy with the whole of the Athanasian Creed. But a few years before, he'd been asked to deliver a series of Bampton lectures — these are public theological lectures delivered at Oxford — on the scholastic philosophy. In the course of this, he seemed to have suggested that creeds were a mistake, that people shouldn't have to sign the 39 Articles to become students at Oxford, and that people should just read the Bible. Now, in fact, this was because he wanted to exalt the Bible above all creeds and above human speculation. He wanted to warn against speculation in theology, but the Tractarians saw a suggestion that he was unsound in the faith. It didn't help that he had been a great friend of Blanco White, who had just become a Unitarian. Hampton was certainly in favour of relaxing the rules on subscription to the Articles at Oxford. He wanted to allow nonconformists into the university. He wanted to expand the university's teaching. But of course, this raised the opposition of the Tractarians. Tempers were high, and while Hampton's appointment could not be blocked because it was made by the king himself, things could be made very difficult for him. A combination of Tractarians and Evangelicals managed to secure a vote in convocation, the governing body of the university, that deprived him of any share in appointing university preachers. It was a great victory, and the Tractarians were instrumental, but they also made a rod for their own backs in doing so. Well, Harold Froude had never been a well man, and on the 28th of February 1836 he finally succumbed to the tuberculosis that had blighted his life for years. Since 1833, as I said, he had been in Barbados, where on one hand he had recommended that respectable coloured people, his language, be admitted to Codrington College, which was the college on the island, and on the other hand complained about all these black people wandering around the place. Finally, despairing of recovery, he returned in late 1835 to die in his home country. Keble and Newman, his closest friends, were devastated by the loss. After his death, his literary remains, his books and papers, including a private journal that he had kept, came into the hands of Newman and Keble as his literary executors, and as they read, they were amazed at the portrait of their friend that emerged. They saw his bodily austerities, his fasting, his sleeping on the floor, his concern for the church, his love of the Middle Ages, his concern for holiness. And so they resolved to publish. To publish what they saw as a memorial to a great man cut off in his prime. Their names were published in 1838 and contained the personal journal as well as letters and essays. It was the journal that drew most attention, not for the reason that Newman and Keble had hoped. The trouble, you see, with publishing personal material is that it is personal. Now, if you know a man, you interpret what he says by the man you know. If you don't know a man, you interpret the man by what he says. And the journal, to be frank, was not all that edifying. It reads rather like a schoolboy who has resolved, I will be good, and then writes down all his efforts to be good and his efforts to try to keep this promise. It was very juvenile. It was authentic, to use a modern buzzword. It's also a great indication, a great example of why authenticity isn't always a good thing. There was another problem, Froude and his fraudacity. He loved to be shocking, and he even came out in his journals. Readers met with a statement from an ordained Anglican clergyman, mind you, saying, really, I hate the Reformation and the Reformers more and more. And they read. They found him praising the Middle Ages and being very rude about the Reformers. The Lady Margaret Professor of Divinity, that's a lesser Professor of Divinity, Godfrey Fawcett, was so horrified he preached a sermon against it. Newman, being the clever man he was, replied with a very clever pamphlet that took Fawcett to pieces and made him look very silly, which was very clever in one sense, and in another sense it was very foolish, because it made an enemy. Leaders who had hitherto ignored the movement looked on it as a danger. But there were others as well, the Romanizers. While liberals and evangelicals and even moderate high church people viewed the publication of Froude's remains with alarm, there were others who welcomed it as a sign from heaven. They saw Froude's personal example of self-discipline, his romantic vision of the medieval church, his passionate dislike of the Reformation, and his ambitions to move the CV away from Protestantism, and they were inspired to follow in his, as they saw it, hallowed footsteps. We shall call them, as they've been called by others, the Romanizers. They had little love for the Church of England, though they were, of course, all Anglicans, and little sense of history either. Where Keble, Newman and Pusey looked to the 4th and 5th centuries, and Farrell looked to the Middle Ages, these men tended to look to the Roman Catholic Church as it existed in the early 19th century. It seemed to them that it was what the C of E was not. It was Catholic. It was exotic. It allowed variety in a way that some felt the Church of England did not. Who were they? Well, there were many of them. They included J.B. Morse, who had such a mania for fasting that in one sermon he recommended that his congregation, if at all possible, make their animals, their dogs and cats and horses and cattle, fast on fast days. He made almost every sermon he preached, no matter what the text was, he would arrive at, this is a text about fasting. He was a monomaniac in that sense. There was John Dalgairns from Guernsey. There was Ernest F.W. Faber, later to be a noted poet. The chief men were William George Ward and Frederick Oakley, both from Balliol College. Ward, born in 1812, had been a liberal for a while, but had been turned to the movement by attending one of Newman's sermons. He became passionately attached to Newman. Ward was a brilliant man in many ways. Very good at arguing. He had a very logical mind. But he was awful at actually doing any study of facts. He would grab a fact and he would elaborate on it logically. It meant he was brilliant in the Oxford Union Debating Society. People hated to face him. He could argue the House almost into any into voting in the affirmative on any proposition. He was a gifted mathematician, so he was appointed a maths tutor, but said he had little sense of history, and his logic seemed to draw him closer and closer to Rome. He also had a great sense of humour. He was noted for his being able to sing comic opera, and he would often be found wandering through the fields around Oxford, belting out some comic opera tune. He rarely behaved like a clergyman. Frederick Oakley, on the other hand, was older. He was born in Shrewsbury in 1802 at Abbey House. His grandfather was the vicar at Shrewsbury Abbey. He was interested in theology, and he had won a theological prize at university in 1827. He was also, another local connection, brought up, after his family left Shrewsbury, brought up in Lichfield at the Bishop's Palace, and he'd attended as a boy from about the age of 10 the daily service in Lichfield Cathedral, which gave him a great love of cathedral services and choral worship. He resigned his tutorship in 1837 and was appointed a Whitehall preacher, which meant that he gave sermons in the Chapel Royal, what's essentially the old banqueting house in Whitehall. In 1839 he became the vicar, the minister rather, of Margaret Chapel, a private chapel in the West End of London. It was a proprietary chapel, that was a private chapel that was didn't have a parish attached, and the minister was appointed by the owner. The building had been erected for a nonconformist congregation, but eventually become Anglican. It had been typical, like that church we saw at the beginning, with a high three-decker pulpit and galleries. But when he became the minister, he took the high pulpit down and replaced it, as you see here, with an altar. Swept away the old pews, put in new benches, and began to work out the implications of the movement in corporate worship. He also managed to make an enemy of the caretaker and clerk of the congregation, who resented being removed from his position of leading congregational worship. Now, the caretaker lived next to the chapel. In fact, there was a connecting corridor between the two. And this corridor had a door at the end that the caretaker would leave open to allow his very large family of cats to wander around the chapel during worship. On one occasion, one of these cats got up onto the gallery front, the three-sided gallery, and began to walk along the gallery front, getting closer and closer to the communion table end, the altar end. Reaching the end, the cat did what cats often do when they get to the end of things like that, thought about jumping down onto the communion table. At this point, the caretaker became quite concerned about this and began to creep up on the cat from behind. The cat, however, noticed and leaped down into the body of the church, narrowly missing John Henry Newman's head. At this moment, the cat realised everyone was looking at it, looked around, and streaked out of the building at high speed. Newman thankfully saw the funny side and afterwards commented, "Oakley, the last time I saw a cat in church was in Rome. It's quite clear to me then that you are indeed leading this congregation towards Rome." Margaret Chapel was swept away in the 1850s but replaced with a grand Gothic building. Also among this Romanizing group was James Anthony Froude, who was Harold Froude's younger brother, born in 1818, who had joined the movement under his brother's influence and fallen in with these younger men. He was one who would find the movement ultimately destructive to his personal faith and ended up as a theological liberal with very little connection with organized religion at all. These men talked openly about their love of Rome, and Newman became very concerned. Keble's away in the country. Pusey lost his wife to illness in 1839, and this loss was so devastating to him that he withdrew into self-imposed or this hermit state in his rooms in Christchurch. So neither Keble nor Pusey could have much influence over these men. So it was to Newman that they unburdened their souls and talked of the power drawing them toward Rome. Something had to be done to keep them. Newman wanted to present the C of E as Catholic, not Roman, not Protestant, but a via media, was the word he used, a middle way. The concept he traced back to the 17th century. And the idea was Rome had got into excess. The Protestants had taken away too much. And so the C of E could be truly, or should be truly, Catholic. But in 1839, this was challenged in an article in the Dublin Review, a Roman Catholic magazine, that was written by Bishop Wiseman, who was the leading Roman Catholic clergyman in England. The article pointed to Donatist controversy of the 4th and 5th centuries. That's to do, of course, with Augustine of Hippo. It was a rigorist group who had split from the ancient Catholic Church over the question of readmission of people who had lapsed under persecution. Wiseman pointed out that even though the Donatists believed all the things that Augustine believed, they were still schismatics, heretics. And so the C of E, even if it believed the fullness of Catholic doctrine, if it did not submit to the Pope, Wiseman said, is in schism, is heretical even. The argument was devastating to Newman. His reading in church history was soon coloured by the same issue. Reading of the Monophysite controversy in the 5th century, he found himself seeing the Protestants as the Nestorians, and the Church of Rome as the Catholics, while the Anglicans were the Monophysites. The comparison puzzles many, but that is the comparison he made. In an attempt to contradict this, he wrote a couple of tracts against Romanism, but was never really able to convince himself. At last, in January 1841, he produced what he hoped would be the decisive tract to hold the Romanizers back. Well, it would be decisive, but not the way that he thought. The Romanizers began to complain about the 39 Articles, the authorized theological standard, the C of E. While the liturgy could be understood in a Romanist manner, the Articles, which speak of justification by faith, predestination, and so on, and speak of the church being capable of error, were decidedly, or seemed to be decidedly, Protestant. Were this the case, Newman saw, there would be no way to keep the Romanizers from going over. Therefore, he took up his pen to write remarks on certain passages in the 39 Articles. In the tract, he sought to show it was both possible and legitimate to understand certain statements in the Articles in more than one sense. His argument was that this was intentional, and the Articles had been framed in such a way as to include as many as possible, as many people as possible, within the Church of England. Our Articles, he wrote, the offspring of an un-Catholic age, are, through God's good providence, to say the least, not un-Catholic, and may be subscribed by those who aim at being Catholic in heart and doctrine. Reading the book today, and here's a small book, it's hard to see how Newman's argument in some places could have been accepted by him, let alone anybody else. He did not engage in serious historical scholarship, but he begged the question. He said, well, Catholic doctrine must be the standard by which we interpret the Articles. But who gets to decide what Catholic doctrine is? Well, the answer at this point was basically Newman. He was trying to keep the movement from falling apart, and he failed. He caused major, serious outrage. Many people read it and thought that it was thoroughly dishonest. Among them, the most notable, perhaps, was Archibald Tait, a Scotsman who later became the Archbishop of Canterbury. At the time, he was an Oxford tutor. He was working in his rooms when Ward hurried in with a tract lying in his hand. "Here's something worth reading," he said, and put it down on the desk. well, take Reddit, and decided whether worth reading or not, it was heretical. It was worth protesting about. He swiftly contacted three other senior college tutors, and they drafted a public letter of protest. Within days, Track 90 was at the centre of a veritable firestorm. The Bishop of Oxford, Richard Bagot, demanded the publication of the tracts be stopped, and Newman obeyed, though not without bitter disappointment. Worse was to come, because Ward came to the defence of Track 90 with a pamphlet of his own that showed that he had completely failed to appreciate what Newman was actually trying to do. Newman insisted the articles were deliberately ambiguous, and so in subscribing them in a Catholic sense, he was being faithful to their historical intent. Ward cheerfully said that of course the articles were meant to be read in Protestant sense. There's no other way to read Article 12, the one justification. But, he replied, I am justified in signing the articles in a non-natural sense. These words were taken to heart by many, and Newman did not repudiate Ward. He couldn't, he was struggling at the time, and to repudiate Ward would have been to split the movement and send Ward over to Rome. Pusey was upset. He regarded the Reformation as a providential blessing, preserving the Catholic nature of the Church of England. But now Newman seemed to be agreeing with Froude that it was a great evil. A rift was opened that would never be closed. Another shock came when in October 1841 the Church of England announced that they would be cooperating with the Prussian State Church in establishing a Protestant bishopric in Jerusalem. To many this was a good thing. It would bring episcopacy into the Prussian State Church. It didn't, but also it allowed the appointment of Bishop Michael Solomon Alexander, a converted Jew, to a bishopric in Jerusalem, where he would be able to minister to other Jewish people and try to bring them to Christ. But to Newman, it was a betrayal. Here was the Church of England cooperating with continental foreign Protestants, Lutherans, and Calvinists. But, of course, the project succeeded, and Newman felt it a stab to the heart. The next crisis was the poetry professorship. Keble's term as professor of poetry came to an end in 1841. Naturally, the Tractarians looked for one of their own, Isaac Williams, a fairly inoffensive Welshman, to replace him. Williams was no great poet, but had written some poetry. The trouble was that he was a Tractarian and had written a tract. Tract entitled On Reserve in Communicating Religious Knowledge. Williams, sensitive soul that he was, felt that certain subjects were better kept from the common people, among them the atonement. Of course, the evangelicals were outraged at this. They even suspected him of teaching one thing in public and another in private. The result was that they brought their own alternative candidate, James Garbutt, and the contest was fought on party lines. Williams, realising that he was very likely to lose the vote, withdrew. It was a notable defeat for the movement and another major shock to Newman. Newman was tired. He had been the centre of the movement for almost a decade, and it was a busy, enthusiastic movement. The second generation looked to him rather than Pusey or Keble and gathered around him. Pusey and Keble were married. These younger men were great fans of clerical celibacy and regarded marriage in a clergyman as almost apostasy. And so they gathered around Newman. Ward pestered him regularly, asking incessant questions, pressing on him this consistent logic of everything, in a way that seemed to lead always to Rome. In November 1841, he left Oxford and went to Littlemore, a village that was in the parish of St. Mary's, where he built a little church in 1835. There he tried to establish a little monastic community to get some peace and quiet and teach some young men It was not to be. The idea of a Tractarian monastery drew many people to look. One newspaper spoke of a grand monastic house rising, with cells of dormitories, cloister and chapel. Well, that's not a grand monastic house. That's little more than a row of sheds. And the cloister is a little garden. And people were coming in, poking around and seeing what they could find there, which, of course, Newman found most annoying. But there he settled down, and some of the more extreme men came, the young men came, to stay with him. He resigned his editorship of the British Critic, and wrote later on, from the end of 1841, I was on my deathbed as regards my membership of the Anglican Church. With Newman withdrawn very much from the scene of action, Warden Oakley took the lead. Oakley contributed a series of increasingly inflammatory and unbalanced articles to the British Critic, in which he lambasted the reformers as traitors and lauded Roman Catholic worship and piety. Subscribers began to cancel one after the other, and eventually the magazine ceased publication in 1843. While Newman had resigned the editorship, many people didn't realise it, and so everything in the magazine was attributed to him. On the 14th of May, 1843, Pusey preached a sermon entitled The Holy Eucharist of Comfort to the Penitent, in the course of which some felt that he had taught transubstantiation. The result was that complaints were made, an investigation ended in him being suspended from preaching for 2 years. The tide had definitely turned. Not long afterwards, one of Newman's young men at Littlemore joined the Roman Catholic Church. Newman, suffering from burnout, as we would say today, took the extraordinary step of resigning from his pastorate. On September the 25th, he preached his last Anglican sermon in his little church at Littlemore, called The Parting of Friends. It's a passionate, a sorrowful sermon. Scripture is a refuge in any trouble. Let us use it according to our measure. It is far higher and wider than our need, and its language veils our feelings while it gives vent to them. It is sacred and heavenly, and it restrains and purifies while it sanctions them. Finishing the sermon, he took off his hood and flung it over the communion rails. His Anglican ministry was over. His last Anglican project, which we'll touch on very briefly, was a series of Lives of the English Saints. It was meant to impress upon these wild spirits the true sanctity and Catholicity of the English Church. By April of 1844, Newman had compiled a list of over 300 saints and began to assign saints to intended authors. Among them was R.W. Church, one of the moderate men and perhaps the best historian among them. To him were assigned the lives of St. Lanfranc and St. Anselm, Norman Archbishops of Canterbury. The whole business, however, rapidly ascended to farce. The first volume to be completed was Dalgairn's Life of St. Stephen Harding. Harding was one of the founders of the Cistercian Order. The volume was completely uncritical, accepting every legend ever told about Harding as true, however late and unhistorical the legends might be. In fact, only Church and J.A. Froude were careful, critical scholars. Froude was assigned St. Neot. Yes, St. Neot is named for a real person, of whom very little is known. And so what Froude published was not a history of St. Neot, but the legend of St. Neot, saying this is what the legend is. This is all, he is reported to have said, and rather more than all, that is known of the life of St. Neot. The result was, of course, the publisher got cold feet, dropped the whole thing, Newman dropped the whole thing, and it ended in utter chaos. It marked the end of Newman's public involvement. Then came the great disaster. Ward published a massive, practically unreadable book in June 1844, the ideal of a Christian church. Over 600 pages in length, it praised Rome and denigrated the Church of England. His great mark of a true church was sanctity, by which he meant something along the lines of the ability to produce saints. Most concerning were, however, the quotes found here on the page, and I apologise for the pop-up that's appeared. Oh, most joyful, most wonderful, we find the whole cycle of Roman doctrine gradually possessing numbers of English churchmen. 3 years have passed since I said plainly that in subscribing the articles I renounce no one Roman doctrine. And he boasted that no one called him to account for any of this. Well, you can probably imagine what happened next. They called him to account for it. The book was condemned, and Ward found himself facing a trial before convocation. Three propositions were put. The first condemned the book. The second sentenced Ward to be stripped of his degrees. And the third, well, initially it said that all Oxford students had to subscribe the articles in the sense originally proposed, but this was later changed to a condemnation of Tract 90. On the 13th of February, a cold, snowy winter's day, the Sheldonian Theatre in Oxford was packed to the rafters. Ward was allowed to give his defence in English. This was unusual. Normally you had to speak in Latin in the Sheldonian. But the vote, in spite of his language, in spite of his oratory, was decisive. The book was condemned by 777 votes to 386. The second proposition, that he be stripped of his degrees, was passed more narrowly by 569 to 511. Before the third could be voted on, the two university proctors rose to their feet and vetoed it. Tract 90 was not condemned, but Ward was. He left Oxford defiant, but with only one course ahead of him, to go to Rome. So he did, but before he did something that shocked everybody other than those it amused. On the 31st of March 1845, William G. Ward, the great upholder of clerical celibacy, got married. The reason was that he had decided he wasn't called to the ministry at all. He was soon after received into the Roman Church. He was among the first, but not the last. The final crisis was Oakley's. He had been claiming the right to hold, but not to preach, all Roman doctrine while ministering the C of E. And after Ward's condemnation, he published a pamphlet saying so. His bishop, Bishop Blomfield of London, immediately called for him and told him to stop it, as you can imagine. Oakley agreed and said, of course, as the bishop asked him, this conversation will be private. And so Oakley went straight back home and wrote an open letter, which was immediately published. The bishop, however, knew someone at the Prince, and as soon as the open letter was in the press, the bishop sent a letter to Oakley saying that he would no longer be allowed to minister in the Diocese of London. There was a trial, which again descended to farce when Oakley got into his head that if he didn't appear before the trial, they couldn't condemn him. Of course they could, and they did. By September of 1845, he was set on a course to Rome. On the 29th of October, he was received into the Roman Catholic Church in the chapel of St. Clement's. The chapel of St. Ignatius in Oxford. Newman wanted to go over too, really. He'd felt the attraction for years. But he was troubled, as Oakley and Ward never could have been, by the problem of history. 19th century Rome was clearly not the Church of the Fathers. It believed many things. He had stated in one of his tracts. He went through the Roman doctrine of purgatory and showed that it has no root in the Bible, no root in the Church of the Fathers. And yet Rome taught it and insisted that it was taught. So he spent much of 1844 to 45 writing a book an essay on the development of Christian doctrine, which proposed the idea for which he is best known today, that there is a historic development of doctrine over time. He used the picture of the acorn and the oak. The acorn is a tiny little thing, the oak a great tree, and yet everything that makes up that oak was in the acorn. All potential was there. And so he felt, he said, that that's what happens with the church. You have everything in potential, and it develops over time. In a higher world, he wrote, it is otherwise. But here below, to live is to change, and to be perfect is to have changed often. But how was true development be distinguished from false? Well, ultimately, he was never able to give a satisfactory answer. One thing he knew, however, Rome provided an infallible church. Rome provided a place where he could be a monk. And so, on the 9th of October 1845, John Henry Newman was received into the Roman Catholic Church at Littlemore, in his little monastery, by Father Dominic Barberi, a Passionist father based at Aston-by-Stow. The Oxford movement was over. It had, of course, its aftermath. The Anglicans remained most of them Anglicans. Pusey and Keble remained in the Church of England, as did Isaac Williams. Tried to make the church Catholic. Keble died in March 1866 after a long parish ministry. Keble died in 1882, still in Christ Church College. The Anglo-Catholic Party in the Church of England survives to this day. Newman and many other converts to Rome worked in the cities, not so much trying to bring people over to Rome, but trying to teach and to help the people. Newman died in 1890, having been raised to the rank of cardinal in 1879 in recognition of his work. Today he is regarded as one of the most significant Roman Catholic theologians of the 19th century. Postscript is that if you go up to the Moorlands, when Margaret Chapel was demolished, most of the furniture was taken to St. Luke's Sheen, which was being rebuilt at the same time by the same man. And wanting to save money, he just took the pulpit, the organ, the pews, and so on from Margaret Chapel to Sheen, so that St. Luke's Sheen can boast that John Henry Newman preached from their pulpit. Not, of course, while it was in Sheen. And so we see in the Oxford movement this fascinating group of people. We can learn a few lessons. I shall be brief in pointing out. The first one is that holiness matters. The Oxford movement emphasised holiness of life. Now, its means of promoting it were mystical and ascetic, but the desire for that was there. There was a worldly Anglican church threatened by what seemed, at the beginning at least, to be an increasingly hostile world. The church, in the face of a hostile world, is called to holiness. Secondly, the church matters. The Oxford movement was called High Church for a reason. They regarded the church as a divine society founded by God. And so it is. They regarded the church as necessary for the perfect development of the Christian life, and so it is. Now, how they identified the church is not correct, but the emphasis, the church matters, is important. History matters. These lectures are intended to emphasise this, and they too point us to this. What is church history? Is it a process of decay from initial purity, followed by a recovery of that purity? Or is it more complicated, a process of growth, development, not merely linear, but including wrong turnings, things that do need to be corrected, and yet there is growth and development. And thirdly, and most importantly, theology matters. Theology matters. The Tractarians were worried that a non-dogmatic Christianity was arising. And we, too, must resist non-dogmatic Christianity. We must make sure that theology interprets our experiences and not the other way around. The cart and horse need to be in the right relation. First the doctrine, then the life. Here, then, we can learn from them, from their mistakes, as well as from the things that they did right. May we do so, and may we learn that we can learn from those with whom we disagree. Thank you.